You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Guy music. Alright, I told you Andy Milburn was going to join us this morning, and he does, so I haven't talked to Andy in forever, I think since he was a lieutenant. Andy, what's up? Good morning. How are you? Uh-oh. I don't hear him. Hey, unmute yourself.
Hey, Matt, can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Like, what'd you do? You, like, put yourself...
I blame it on your instruction at IOC. I never led me through. I never quite grasped the technical elements. Remember how I used to struggle with... what is it we used to do with machine guns? Fire them from defilade, and, you know, where you had to balance the compass, and I could never work out the calculations.
Yeah, but there's
that.
No...
There's
no need to, like, demonstrate it live on the radio, though. You could have just kept... You could have just let it have been our secret.
That was a bad debut. Yep. Okay, well, I'm here now, man. I guess I've eaten into my
No. Hey, look, it's my show. We have as much time as I want to take. First of all, we have to talk about you a little bit. So, right, I'm sure people heard me, you know, just say, you know, I haven't, you know, talked to Andy since I taught him, and you come on, right? And you don't sound like your basic Marine. So let's tell everybody your story. First of all, born and raised where?
Yeah, so I was born in the UK. I'm a first generation immigrant, and actually, yeah, I wanted to join. You know, you probably don't realize this, and it's too late to blame me. But I wanted to join the British Army. I mean, that was my deal. I had what I thought was a short service commission lined up, and broke my leg playing rugby. My leg, by the way, still does not bend 90 degrees, and I failed every single physical I've ever done in the Marine Corps. But so the British Army flunked me. You know, it was like a whatever it is below a 4F. You know, it's like
right.
Never come back, dude.
Right.
So I thought my life was over. Don't worry, man. I'll get to the end of the story quickly.
This is good stuff. And just goes to show to everybody. Look, Marine Corps. Right? Never be afraid to get a waiver out or lower your standards. Okay.
Anyway, so. So my mother was American, so I had dual citizenship,
right.
and I went to law school. This is how desperate I was, and took a year off at the end of law school to travel the world. Ran into some Marines in Pakistan. These were the first U.S. Marines I'd met. I ran into them in the embassy in Islamabad, and I was really impressed. These guys, Mac, were living the life of Riley. They took me back to the Marine house where they lived, and they had a pool table. You know, they were throwing a party that night. It seemed like anyone who was anyone in Islamabad, which isn't saying much, I know, wanted to be seen at the Marine house. So I was thinking, these dudes have a great life. I want some of that. I'm gonna take this program for about 4 years.
Because we all live like that, don't you know?
Yeah. Well, you know better, man. I may have graduated law school, but I was perhaps a little short.
Okay, hold on. Okay, so hold on. Let me stop you. So when you say you were born in the UK, what does that mean? Like, where in the UK?
Well, actually, I'm going to rephrase. I was born in Hong Kong, which was a British colony back then.
Right.
And my father had been in the Royal Navy and then Hong Kong government. So, you know, the way things were back then, I mean, I grew up in Hong Kong, but I... until I was 8, and then I went to boarding school in the UK. And so I went to boarding school and then university in the UK. So I'd never been.
So you went to boarding school as a little kid?
Well, yeah, 8, you know, 8.
So you're
18.
Like, so you were like rolling around in the blazer and the cap and all that stuff, like we see on TV?
Yeah, straw hat, man. You graduate to wearing a straw hat when you're 13, along with long pants.
Nice! Oh, before you got to wear the shorts? That's how they know you're a boot?
That's right. Well, yeah. So you'll see, actually, British boarding school parlayed very well into being a Marine. You know, I mean, I've been institutionalized since I was 8. But let me...
No, okay, hold on. Now, we have to digress again. So, get out your crystal ball. How long is the Chinese mainland government going to sit around and watch Hong Kong play stupid before they do something? Or will they just wait them out?
Yeah, this is fascinating. I think in the end, the Chinese government's going to have to compromise. And I don't want to draw parallels with Tiananmen.
Right.
You know, that was 30-something years ago. Right. Hopefully... the Chinese administration has learned, a considerable amount since then, but the reaction back then, remember, was to pretend it never happened. You know, massive, massive crackdown. We still don't know how many dozens, maybe hundreds of students were killed. And then now it's as though that never happened.
Right.
What's happening in Hong Kong is so much in the public domain. And I think the Chinese government hopefully has that I can't see that happening. I think that has to be a compromise. But I think it's going to be a pretty small compromise. I think, you know, the immediate cause of the riots right now is the fact that the Chinese government has said that they will, one of the reasons is that they will extradite or they will try and imprison protesters, Hong Kong belongers, as they're called, on the Chinese mainland, and that's what sparked these riots. So maybe the government will turn around and compromise on that one point, but I can't imagine a wider compromise.
Interesting. It's fascinating because there's an economic component to that, right? I mean, their economy is struggling, and they're just now, I just saw some reporting about Tiananmen Square, and they said that they've almost completely, removed any physical scar, and there's nothing in history books, and whoever was interviewing people in the vicinity of Tiananmen Square, maybe in Tiananmen Square, were asking people about it, and they're like, I don't know what you're talking about, and they're saying how scary this is. So the specter of almost having that one wiped out with a protest that's magnitude times what, I'm not even sure, and then also with the economic consequences that would surely come with it because of the freedom of the media in Hong Kong that wasn't in Tiananmen Square. Pretty interesting little thing they're going through. So interesting.
Yeah, huge. And Hong Kong's like to the Chinese government is the goose that lays the golden eggs.
Right.
You know, and here they are now being confronted with, do they crack down and kill that goose?
Exactly.
Or do they work out a way to kind of muzzle it and keep it laying the golden eggs.
Okay, so all right, so now we're done with China. We go back.
Yeah, yeah.
We go back to your Harry Potter like upbringing, right. and how you wound your way into the Marine Corps after you saw Shangri-La of the way our MSG dudes live in certain places of the world. So you're going to high school in a uniform, and what part of the UK? When you say UK now, you're talking about England.
London. I went through boarding school in a place in southern England. Some of you guys may have, some of your listeners may have probably been to Southampton or Portsmouth on deployment. And so the school I went to was not far from there. And then to, university in London, University College London. By the way, do you remember that dude? I forget his name, who said his underwear alight over Detroit. About 10 years ago.
What did he do?
Do you remember the underwear bomber?
Yeah, that was not a good decision. Talk about poor decisions. Yeah, I remember that guy.
Yeah, he was an alumni of that same college as me a few years afterwards.
Hey, look, I don't want to tell you how to live your life. But if I was you and I could advise your school, you might want to expunge that record from your rolls.
Oh, I think so, yeah. And, yeah, it gets better. So at law school, a few years after me, but I went to where Jihad John was a student.
What the hell?
Some years after me. So you can see, you know, I mean, the school, I don't go to school reunions, but conceivably, you know, a few years ago, I could have shown up and been in the same room, you know, exchanging cocktails or whatever with Jihadi John. And he was actually, you know, no joke. He led the Islamic Student Union back when he was there as a student.
Wow.
But I digress, Mac. I'm sorry, man.
No. This is what I love about my show. Right? It's like Stewart's ride around McClellan. We'll get there at some point, as he showed up 2 days late.
That's good because I'm dying to tell a story about IOC, man. It's a good
what? Hey, just use your judgment because this program has technical difficulties all the time, and you could be it's just as we struggled to get you on. It will be no problem struggling to keep you on. So be warned, there, Andy.
No, this is a good one. Anyway, so jumping ahead, I ran into a Marine recruiter in London. There was one back in the 80s because there were U.S. high schools, remember, you know, throughout Europe during the Cold War. And I was his quota for 1987, man. I mean, I graduated law school. I drove a hard bargain, though, Mac. I was guaranteed PFC out of boot camp and guaranteed infantry. I mean, I run that dude dry. My parents were less than thrilled, you know, having seen me graduate law school and me explaining to them that it was not for nothing that I was going to wear a stripe, you know, coming out of boot camp. It took them some time to forgive me. But that was, so the intention was that was going to be for 4 years, right? And I was going to go back and practice law, but somehow my plans went awry and I found myself getting commissioned and then, you know, here I am 32 years ahead. But by the way, before I get us back on topic, Paris Island was my first introduction to the United States. So you can imagine, man, I mean, I was like, this country sucks.
Wait a minute. So you enlist from the UK?
Yeah. So here's how it happened.
How the hell would that even happen? How would you go through a physical? Did you have to fly here to Memphis the physical?
An Air Force doctor at Lakenheath who did all the entry level physicals. So I went to Lakenheath for that. I did my ASVAB and everything in a adjunct to the U.S. Embassy. It was called the Naval Annex there in Grosvenor Square in London. I did go through MEPS, but in New York. So technically, that was my first step in the United States, and I failed the physical there. Right. So, you know, when they have you do the duck walk, I still can't do the duck walk, man. So they're like, you're in a pathetic physical condition. So we're going to send you back. I'm afraid you can't make it into the military. You don't meet the physical qualifications. So I'm not lying, Mac. I mean, I might lie to you, but I wouldn't lie to all your listeners. But here's what's happened. So they stuck in this line of physical rejects, and when it comes to my turn, they realized that I came there on a one way ticket, and they couldn't work out the funding line to send me back to the UK because they didn't get it hadn't happened to them before that they had a recruit from the UK who failed, you know. So if I'd been in the States, it was easy enough, but there was no funding line, so they hemmed and hawed for the best part of about 2 hours. And then in the end, they're like, okay, you're going to Paris Island.
it's the easiest thing to do.
Yeah, it's just much bureaucratically easy. Get on the bus, you know. So there it was. Yeah, so Paris Island was, I mean, to say it was a cultural shock would be an understatement. Yeah, I mean, back in the, you know, you came in the 80s, so you can imagine recruit training then, and especially 3rd Battalion Paris Island. I know 3rd Battalion came under some close scrutiny just a couple of years ago in 2016. Yeah. But honestly, I mean, for better or for worse, I think mainly for worse, Paris, 3rd Recruit Training Battalion has always had kind of a reputation for steering across, you know, across boundaries. Hey, do you know John?
Wait a minute. You're speaking in code, okay? You're speaking of code. It's not Thundering Herd, right? Isn't it like Thumping Third?
No, it's Thumping.
Thumping.
So,
yeah.
So how does a battalion get a nickname like Thumping Third, you know?
Right.
And why is it?
It's not because they shy away from thumping.
No, and the battalion was hidden away in a remote part of Paris Island back then. So, you know, it was kind of like in space, no one can hear you scream. I've still got a scar, actually, across the bridge of my nose. I know a lot of guys like telling horror stories about recruit training or whatever it was, IOC, but I legitimately have a scar across the bridge of my nose from where I was, you know, it was rammed into a bunk by a drill instructor trying to be helpful on explaining how to clean my weapon. But those lessons stay with you. Anyway, John Monahan. You must know John Monahan.
You know what? He's one of those people that I've heard of him forever. I don't think I've ever met him. I've met his daughter.
Yeah, yeah. So John was my series commander. I'm not blaming him for, you know, Thumping Third and all that. He was my series commander, and then he was my company commander when I was a second lieutenant. So what are the chances of that? He was poor, you know, poor bastard. I mean, he was settled with me as a private and then again as a second lieutenant, which probably the, you know, the two kind of lost ranks in the Marine Corps.
Wow.
But for better or for worse. Anyway, sorry, bring you up to date.
No, keep going. So take us through your career, Andy.
So out of boot camp, remember I'd driven a hard bargain with infantry. I was an 0351 Dragon gunner. Do you remember the Dragon?
Of course I do.
You must remember that, right?
Yeah.
Thank God that weapon's obsolete. You know, it was
yeah, but the guys who shot it at the time, right, it was a smaller portable version of a tow missile. And it was wire-guided, anti-tank thing. And the guys who shot it, guys like Andy, they could, you know, you'd see a target behind a tree, and you'd say, okay, well, pick, and you're out on the range, like, we'll pick another one. And like, no, sir, I'll hit it. Like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
And they would do tricks with this thing. They'd fire it to the right and then bring it back. And it was like, holy shit, man, this was awesome. So absolutely, man.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, limited range. And I heard limited penetration, but it was,
right.
but just like, I mean, you remember when you were a platoon commander, there was a certain sort of ethos with certain weapon systems, right? You know, like the Mortarmen were always the bad boy.
Right.
The Dragon gunners had an ethos, you know, not a bad boy ethos, but it was they'd like to think themselves as cut above the average infantryman for whatever reason, just a great bunch of dudes.
Probably because of their, you know, their ASVAB or whatever. You had the GCT of what? 86, 85 to be a grunt, right? 86,
yeah.
86 to be a Dragon gunner. So they were, they were uniquely qualified and hand selected to be that.
And then 89 to be an officer back on the
exactly. But we'll waive it as long as you got the other, as long as you can show us a diploma.
That's right. Or GED. Anyway, cut a long story short. I was commissioned, I guess must have been about 4 years after you, 3 or 4 years after you. In 90, and my first battalion, and you feel free to chime in.
If you were commissioned in 90, I got commissioned in 83, man.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you came
straight
in
up,
the same time.
Straight up
Brian
Boot.
Brian Fitzgibbon.
Yes, Fitz.
Yep. I just saw him the other day, man.
Get out.
He's the best man at my wedding. Fitz and I've been close since, yeah.
That's awesome.
Anyway,
he's a great, Brian Fitzgibbons is a great dude. And nobody knows who, very few people know who we're talking about. But if you do, he's one of the best dudes I've ever met. He's a good man.
Yeah, he's an extraordinary dude. Hey, I'll tell you a quick story about 2.9, then I want to jump back to IOC because a couple of things have stayed with me. My first battalion was 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines. And 2.9, so this was, do you remember when the Gulf War broke out?
We were
all at TVS and IOC, and you may remember that my class thought that we were all going to war, and,
I think I said it, we're going to war, everybody's going to die, so look around. Right. If anybody owes you money, you better collect it right now.
You are not lying. I remember you. I remember saying something.
No, and you want to know what I remember? The Gulf War. We were, here we are. We're instructors at IOC. So you're judged as a relatively competent infantry officer, and the Marine Corps is going to go to war when it never goes to war, and you're not going to be a part of it. And the monitors came down, and they were talking about casualties, and we thought, well, we'll get sent over there. And they looked at us and like, yeah, no, the basic school goes from a 6-month course to a 3.5-month course. IOC goes from, from 11 weeks or 10 weeks, whatever the hell we were, to 5 weeks. And this is the number of casualties we expect to take. We got to generate this. And we're just like so demoralized because the whole Marine Corps is going to war and we're not. And I was I don't mean to make it a selfish thing, but I was thinking more about myself than you.
No, we all were. And how ironic. I mean, we thought that was it. That was our one shot.
Right.
And then sadly, my class found themselves corralled in 29 palms to form what was called then a casualty replacement company because everyone thought that the Gulf War was going to be, was going to be potentially a bloodbath. We're going to lose like 30,000 dudes.
Right.
So we sat in 29 palms and we watched all 100 hours of it on TV there in the in the canteen, the Warrior Club or whatever it was called. And we thought our lives were over. We'd missed out. And then I joined the battalion 2.9. I think it's like the one battalion that had missed the Gulf War. And instead of going to Saudi Arabia and then Kuwait, they sat on the rock. They were on Okinawa. It was supposed to be a 6-month UDP. They were there for a year. No training, ammo, nothing. Just so you can imagine, their morale was sky high by the time I joined the battalion, along with two fellow lieutenants. No, seriously, Mac. I mean, they had some serious alcohol problems, and not just the troops.
Right, Marine Corps. But Marine Corps wide, I mean, that was, when we have issues as a institution, there are acceptable. It wasn't acceptable to say, I think I need to go to mental health, but it was acceptable to be a drunk.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Institutionally, it was acceptable. Things that are and are not acceptable. You look back and it's the dumbest shit in the world, but it was our culture. If you put your hand up and said, hey, I think I need to go talk to somebody and get help. I got some issues. People are like, yeah, he needs,
yeah,
we
was.
Need, yeah. What's up with that? We need to put him in timeout. He's non-deployable.
You're absolutely right. And you probably remember it too. I mean, especially while you're deployed. Also back in CONUS, remember the Friday nights at the O clubs, but deployed up in the O club in, Camp Schwab. I mean, every night there was heavy, heavy drinking. So that was a little bit of a down. Here's something else though, that was a little discouraging and you might have noticed this too, but so a lot of us spilled out of IOC and TBS, having learned all the right things. That was an awesome preparation for the fleet. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. But then what I think what disappointed a lot of us, myself included, and I know a lot of peers, was the standard of leadership, frankly, at battalion command level. I'm retired now, so I can say this, but there were one or two. But it was almost as though the norm was just was the antithesis of everything we had learned about good leadership, persuasive leadership. For every for every good battalion commander, my peers had horror stories about four or five other guys. And it wasn't until later in the 90s that guys started getting being relieved for just being toxic. I mean, now we use the term toxic leaders. I don't actually like that term because you can, if you're toxic, you're not a leader at all. It's kind of an oxymoron. But just being kind of, can I say, shiteheads.
Well, you know, it was a watershed. It's interesting you bring that up, Andy, because, I mean, you know, if you were a lieutenant and you came through the basic school in ILC when I was there in 80, 89, 90, 91, and I think in 92 a little bit, if I recall those years, but the Marine Corps was going through a renaissance of thought under General Gray, and the basic school and the infantry officer course is led at the time by John Kelly, who will become the White House Chief of Staff, a four-star general. He's followed by John Allen, who's now running Brookings, who will become a four-star general, command all troops in Afghanistan, blah, 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 blah. And so these guys are some of the leading men of their time. And certainly, so if you were, as a lieutenant went through, right, you had this heady experience. Well, what the Marine Corps that they were excreted into was not like that. It was still a two up, one back, right?
When they're not legacy.
Yeah, lieutenant.
Shaken out, yes.
Yeah, lieutenant, when I want to hear what you have to say, you'll see my pants around my ankles, and I'll be waving my hands over my head, okay? Until then, you shut up, and you do what you're told. You got it? And that's the Marine Corps they went to. And you would get these phone calls on a routine basis saying, hey, sir, I don't know what to do. I gave my opinion. And I got called in the office, and I got destroyed. Yeah, well, then shut up. Don't say another word to that guy. So
very, very true.
That's tough.
But so it was kind of, watershed's a good term for it. Absolutely right. So then Major Allen was my IOC instructor. But I'll tell you, so going back to kind of the positive aspect of this, was that we were really, really were set up for the right things at IOC. And, you know, I think most of all, what stays with me, I still have the book with, the 15-minute. Do you remember, the 15-minute mini lectures in the morning?
Yep.
So, those even more than the tactics stay with me. Little things like, I remember Fitz, maybe Fitz telling, talking about the fine line between fraternization with your boys when you're a platoon commander and how to stay on the right side of that, giving parties at your house and all this, things that you normally wouldn't think about sharing with lieutenants, but which otherwise they would have to learn through hard lessons.
And sometimes sometimes at the peril of their careers, because
that's absolutely right.
They didn't know enough not to do it. They didn't know that hey, look, have a beer and then politely excuse yourself, maybe buy them a round, but you do not want to, get intoxicated and be around them, because one, it'll encourage bad behavior, and two, you can compromise yourself. And, people ask about, I'm still asked, why is that thing such a positive course? And I said, well, first of all, the people that tend to teach are pretty good at leadership. Second of all, the approach is it's intellectual, it's really hard physically, and then there is this genuine Lejeune-like, father, son, daughter, father, this mentor thing that goes on there, that I think it's why we joined. And they go there and they find it there and they're like, oh shit, this is awesome. Not that the basic school isn't so much like that, because it tries to be, but it's just a different beast. And it is really a unique and a wonderful, wonderful, I would say this, intellectual experience combined with a physical experience, combined with the leadership experience that makes guys want to go out and do great things. And so it was, I'll tell you what, you talk about a fun place to teach, Paul Kennedy, Dave Furness, Jody Osterman, Lou Caprotta, John Kelly, John Allen, I'll become two stars or higher things in the Stacy Clarity. All these guys were there, and we would argue like jackasses every day, along with, you know, Fitz and Scott Sobka and other guys that I was there with. But just great, great guys who really were committed to creating a great experience for second lieutenants to go on to do great things with their platoons and hopefully in their careers. So it was, but again, Andy's part of a group that, as I said, went into a Marine Corps that didn't believe in lieutenants having an opinion. And it was an interesting experience that they had, and they had to learn a skill set, those that became successful, about how to be persuasive, how to not be offensive, because often these lieutenants knew more about maneuver warfare, about tactics, techniques, and procedures than their company commanders, which is a pretty awkward spot for a company commander, and they had to learn the social skills to navigate around that. And Andy, part of that group that ultimately changes the Marine Corps, you know, for a great period of time.
Hey, Mac, yeah, you nailed it in the atmosphere at IOC. And to your point about maneuver warfare, you know, we were well steeped in that philosophy. And I know now there's a lot of talk now about mission command and the Army's treating that as though it's a new philosophy. And frankly, you know, the U.S. military is struggling with really adopting mission command as a philosophy. So, and yet we learned it as lieutenants almost 30 years ago, right? You know, maneuver way. But to your point about knowing more than company commanders, I remember we had a PME there in Okinawa, and battalion commanders said, hey, we're going to talk about maneuver warfare. And you know what? For an hour and a half, they talked about maneuver, like maneuver as in maneuver, movement. And I was like, that's not... The lieutenants looking at each other, I don't think you understand what is meant by maneuver warfare. It isn't simply being able to move fast, you know.
Is anybody going to say it, though? Everybody's looking around like...
Oh. Like Emperor's New Clothes, man. And then another quick vignette for you. We landed in, you know, and this gets into this whole thing about following orders. So we land in... 2-9 was the first battalion to land in Somalia in December of 1992. And I'm the mortar platoon commander, so I get given instructions. Say, set up in this location with your mortars and get fire cap. So we set up, but it's a hopeless location, and we quickly realize that there are no need for mortars there, and even if there were, we couldn't hit anything. We wouldn't be allowed to shoot because it's just thick, you know, urban areas all around us, masses of civilians. So I can't raise battalion on the radio. So I give a displacement order to move to a better location. That's, you know, the other side of the port. We have clearer fields of fire. We've got better defensible security. We move, and the next thing you know, I get the operations officer getting me on the net. This is on the battalion net. I'll never forget him saying, you need to go back where you were told to go, Lieutenant. You don't just make decisions by yourself. Pull your head out of your ass, you know, on TAC 1, so you can imagine what. And I was thinking, wait a second, you know, I was exercising initiative here. But it's, you know, that the humiliation of that and just the anger has stayed with me. Don't worry, I mean, I've got over it, though, you know, I mean, but anyway, to your point. Hey, I want to tell a really quick story, Mac, about something that stayed with me to the positive side. When we were at, you know, you talk about the lead up to the Gulf War, and, you know, I remember on one of our field problems, you know, a group of locals had walked past us in the woods, and one of us had made, not me, but someone had made kind of a dismissive comment about rednecks or something, and I remember you hauled us all in. We went admin for about, you know, for however long this took, and you tore reams off us, but it wasn't, you know, yelling. It was a very constructive. It was along the lines of, hey, you know, those, by the way, those guys, you you refer dismissively to represent, you know, American public, who, by the way, pray for you on Sundays and everything. And if you ever think you're, you know, above them in some way, then you don't need to be in this profession. But it was, you said it much more, you know, probably articulately, but that talk, which is very true, and us as privileged college boys deserved every word of it, and has stayed with me, that, you know, that implicit pact with the American people is all important.
Now, you know what, it is, you know, there's, and one of the things I've learned in terms of public speaking is there's how you articulate that. And I used to do this thing, and I don't know how it came into my head, but just a visual that said, you know, those people, I used to do this when I was talking about special trust and confidence. And I developed and taught this class called The Decision, and I still teach it today. It's pretty cool, actually. And it was about decision making, because I looked at, you know, the lieutenants I would walk around, and they'd get confused, and they'd freeze. And it's not really what you want. And so then I started thinking, well, why do they? They're not, like, and Andy's a great example of it. He's an athlete, right? He's played, you know, he's played violent collision sports. He's made reads in those sports, right, to make plays. Yet when we go out into the woods and we play Buddha Buddha Jam and all that, it's like, what do I do? Okay. And aside from being new, right, it didn't seem like they knew what they were looking for. And then I thought, well, what do we teach them? And the answer is, we don't teach them anything. We look at them and say, what now, Lieutenant? And so I put together this class called The Decision. Part of the decision was, what gives you the right to sit here, right, today? Because the Israelis, they select officers from their non-commissioned officers, right? They don't, nobody comes in, you know. And I said, and there's militaries all over the world that do that. So, you know, so what, why do you get to sit here today? And so, well, we're college graduates. And then I would say, who the hell thinks that's any indication of somebody cut from a higher bolt of cloth, right? You know, I don't know anybody, right, who wasn't drunk that flunked out of college, who showed up, right? So obviously, the bar has moved on that one. And I said, because let me tell you what's at stake here. I want you to picture a family who sends their 18-year-old off to recruit training, and he's or she is one of your Marines. And at the time, it would have been a she. I say that now for because I don't want anybody to get pissed at me. He would have been one. He's in your platoon. On the mantle of their home is a baby picture. There's a Little League picture, a Pop Warner picture, right? There's prom pictures, right? Another high school sports picture. And his high school graduation picture, and then his picture as a recruit. And whether there's any more pictures to the right may depend on your ability to do what we do, to make decisions and be good. And the only reason that you can send their son back to them in an aluminum can is that you simply got outfought that day. You did everything in your power, but the enemy does have a vote. But you did everything in your power. And that's important because you have to put your head on your pillow for the rest of your life. And this is a really serious proposition. And so, and what Andy's talking about, whether it's ridiculed those people, and you try to articulate that because they're novices, right? And so I'm sure, Andy, you did that for people. But I mean, there's a way that you can do that. I think that's inspirational, educational, and not condescending and mean, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. And you put it very well. And, you know, I like to think, I mean, I've made, you know, obviously a ton of mistakes and, you know, foolish decisions and everything, but that obligation that was very rightly drilled into us at GBS and IOC, has stayed with me. And so, you know, what since and talked about has all stemmed from that sense of obligation. And, you know, to your point about, you know, they were very movingly said about, you know, it's kind of on you if there are any, if these guys have a partly on you, on your efforts, whether these guys have a future, beyond, you know, beyond now, beyond, you know, the circumstances, in which you're making decisions. the enlisted obligation differs from the officers in one key respect, and that is they promise to obey everyone placed over them. We don't do that. And I think, you know, there's a huge implication for that, and that is that we have to exercise some level of autonomy, call it moral autonomy, in that decision space between receipt of order and execution, because the guys below us don't have that luxury. They have sworn not to. They have sworn to kind of forfeit that peace. And so people who say, hey, the only order that you disobey is an illegal order, either haven't thought hard enough about the question, or lack the intellect, or simply just haven't had the experience to be confronted with the fact that it's not that simple. And I'll give you just a quick example recently. It's not even from the Marine Corps, but we can all dig up examples with our own past. You know, just reading through the investigations and the ProPublica article about the 2017 collisions in the 7th Fleet, you know, the USS Fitzgerald and the John McCain, both involved within weeks of each other in collisions that resulted in 17 deaths. Yes, the approximate causes of those collisions lay on those ships, but they were ultimately a result of just poor decisions made across, you know, up and down the chain, from 7th Fleet leadership all the way up, frankly, to the CNO. But guys kept executing, because they were so rooted in mission first, you know, the mission before the man. And two skippers made the decision to go to sea when they knew their crews were not ready. They knew that, you know, for the sake of mission, which actually they couldn't accomplish. They weren't, you know, the guys weren't trained to do that. They put to sea when they weren't ready. And 17 sailors paid with their lives for that decision. So anyone who says, hey, it's all black and white, it's easy, you obey all legal orders, and by the way, the mission always becomes before the men. I don't want my son or daughter to have to work for a guy like that. I want someone who understands that, yes, you know, you have multiple loyalties, ultimately one to the Constitution, but also to your subordinates, and also to a code of professional ethics, which means sometimes you may have to disobey or refuse an order, because you have seen there is a better outcome. And why is it your right to do that? Well, you were given a commission. It's not your right, but it's your obligation.
It's your responsibility. You know,
to exercise that. It's your responsibility, And take the consequences, by the way. I'm not saying, hey, everyone should be let off the hook. Hey, take the consequences. You may end up getting court-martialed. But that's the way it is. That's why our profession is so tough.
What the most disturbing things that come out of that are, I mean, it's not like one or two people made the mistakes. It starts with the skipper. But the Fitzgerald, the first night under his command, he was the XO, right? They're transiting a shipping lane going 22 knots, right? With a CIC that isn't communicating with the bridge. Neither the CO or the XO
is on the bridge.
The bridge. And so to me, I looked at that and I'm like, okay, look, I mean, most of us have been to sea. You put a company of Marines there, and if we have a degraded radar and we're going to cross the shipping lane, what are we going to do? We're going to double the external watch. Okay? Right? Are we going to cross at 22 knots? No, our radar degraded. Why don't we slow this son of a bitch down? You know, so the mistakes are so fundamental and they're so glaring, and you look at the aftermath and you're just like, that's really, if that's the way naval ships are being crewed these days, that's so disturbing from a leadership perspective. It's honestly frightening. Okay, hold on. Before you talk about that, walk people through the wave tops of your career, so they when we talk about what we're going to talk about next, they get where you're coming from.
Yeah. So after as a lieutenant, I was rifle platoon commander. Then I had 81's platoon. When I came back to the fleet, it was with 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines, and 29 Palms under this guy named Jim Laster, who made 3 stars, and then Blake Crow, who ended up as a 1-star. But it was 29 Palms, awesome, was an awesome place to be. As it turned out, that was the place that we trained for the Iraq War. I was with the battalion for 4 years, which, you know, straddled 9/11, and left the battalion to my bitter disappointment right before it went to war in March of 2003. Orders for a Quantico Coalition Special Warfare Center. But then Colonel Steve Hummer, who was the 7th Marine CO, brought me back on he reached down into Quantico, God bless him, and brought me back to be the future operations of the 7th Marines, which was, you know, just, I mean, it's a terrific opportunity. For the march up, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
so, lucky you.
It was. It was, you know, me and a guy named John Shaw worked for, you know, wrote the plan, at least, you know, for 7th Marines for the invasion of Baghdad and, you know, all the movements before then. So it was an extraordinary experience, and you've probably been in certain units at certain times where it just seemed like there was a wealth of talent there, and everyone got along well, and the morale was high, and it was, you know, it's just hard to replicate that experience. Although I've been fortunate, that has seemed to happen a lot of times in units that I've been in throughout the Marine Corps. It's just, and that's what's kept me in. But anyway, yeah. So after that, I went back to what was then called Coalition Special Warfare Center, and we stood up there the first course for advisors for the Iraqi Army. And it's kind of interesting, a typical Marine Corps. It was like no budget, you know, this was on a shoestring, but it was a critically important mission, you know, because everyone realized training the Iraqi Army was our exit strategy, and putting right guys in those billets was key. And this is kind of a really, I think, a really good glimpse into, you know, the Marine Corps' ethos. So the bottom line is, Marines, although we never specially selected advisors for that program, and although everyone recognized that program was critical and that it took a special type of person to be an advisor for a couple of reasons, not just the fact that you had to be, you know, able to fit in and into a completely different culture and lead via influence, but also you had to be very willing to live away from FOB life, you know, in very austere surroundings. But the Marine Corps never set up a selection program. They set up a training program. But I can tell you that Marine advisors, and you know this too, performed astonishingly well. You know, and you just put Marine in those billets. We did, like, hey, if he's a Marine, he can do this. And for the most part, we were right. I mentioned that because the Army had horrendous problems trying to do the same thing. You know, in the Army, that was traditionally a special forces mission.
Green Beret.
But special forces at the time had their hands full. So they were, the Army was just, you know, throwing every Tom, Dick, and Harry into that mission. And they had, you know, they had dudes quit. They had, you know, I was in Mosul in 2005. We had an Army major just quit as team leader. We had guys refusing to leave to go out on patrol in the streets. We had a lot of issues. So that isn't me being smug about the Marine Corps, I hope. But I think it's justified pride in the fact that whatever alchemy is that we put into, you know, selection, training, we don't select, I mean, I know, but the training and the ethos seemed to carry over very well into that mission and stood us in good stead at a time when that mission really was critical.
All right, keep going on your career.
Yeah. So anyway, so we stood up this course, and it makes me kind of embarrassed to think about it now. You know, it was started off as a 1 week course. We give them a little bit of culture, you know, bring dudes in. You know, you remember that whole thing about don't point your feet at people and all that. Little smattering of Arabic, shooting and all this. And then gradually we expanded it into 3 weeks, again, almost without a budget. I mean, we had to go cap in hand to IOC, TBS, the local hospital to get the medical training. You know, and it was such an important mission. We were shoveling advisors out the door to just train the nascent Iraqi army with this kind of like impromptu preparation, but they did well, right. You know, and which is more than could be said initially for the Iraqi army. April 2004, the first battle of Fallujah, the one Iraqi battalion broke and ran, and it happened to be Marine advisors with that battalion, and they were kind of left hanging to dry, and were very fortunate to escape unscathed. The second battle of Fallujah, we took, two Iraqi battalions back in for Al-Fajr, and I was actually an advisor with one of them, and they did better. It was still a very, very tough grind for the advisors, because we had to do everything for them, you know, communications, fire support, but most of all was the intangible aspect of being there, of having to lead them. There had to be an American leading them into every house. So you can imagine the strain on the advisors was considerable. If you've got one, you're going into house after house as the first or second guy through the door, and you've got, I don't know the statistics now, but probably about 1 in 5 chance of there being Mujahideen there waiting for you. That becomes very, very tiring. And, you know, it made me think at the time, remember when the way we used to do MAUT training, we would do, you know, you were lucky if you did maybe a week or 2 weeks a year, right? And then when we did MAUT training, it was during daytime, and visibility was pretty good, and there was no furniture in the houses. And then suddenly, you know, the realities of urban combat were that, you can barely see, and then once the shooting starts, it's absolute fucking pandemonium. You know, there's dust, and the walls rupture, and everything is dark, and people are tripping over furniture and screaming. I mean, it's like nothing could really prepare you for that. And I found that quite harrowing. I mean, I don't mind taking, I'd rather just sit at home and have a pint of IPA, but, you know, I don't mind taking my, you know, the risks out in the streets or out in the open and mortar fire rockets, but being in a house with medieval savages who are trying to kill you, and you don't know, you can't see anything. And that was definitely a workout. And anyway, advisors did very well. We had one guy killed, several wounded, but the advisor program was a success story. And although taking the Iraqi army to war in that particular instance was a little like, you know, taking Mrs. Moffat's third grade class, you know, on a deadly field trip, as far as having to lead them by the hand, at least they did, you know, and they took casualties too. So it was kind of a glimmerings of hope were there. And then after Fallujah was that died down, I went out to, I took about 2 weeks to kind of travel around Anbar, before my next assignment. And so I visited, some of your listeners may be familiar with these places, but I went to Ramadi, to visit 2-5. I had some friends then, and this was late 2004. It was a very bad time in Anbar.
Did we cross paths? Did you come over to Blue Diamond? Did I see you there?
I have seen you, and I'm pretty sure it was in Iraq. I did go to Blue Diamond, yeah. Well, you were out there around that time, right?
Yeah, I was there. Roger Turner, J.J. Carroll,
yeah, yeah.
John Myrna.
Yep. We were all doing... You guys...
In fact,
I went for lunch with Roger Turner and Myrna and J.J. Carroll. I remember... Because they were talking about putting together, like, the border force at the time.
Right.
Yeah, we must have crossed paths.
All right, keep going. So.
Yeah, yeah. So 2-5, and then I went out to Al-Qaim, where 1-7 under Chris Woodbridge.
Right.
And, you know, the lessons, you remember that this time. The Marine Corps was learning some hard lessons in Anbar around that time, and very, very tough fight at battalion level. You know, by no exaggeration, it was a lucky battalion that went back to the States with fewer than, you know, 15 dead. And a lot of battalions were taking much higher casualties than that. But I don't know what your perspective was. Mine was that the battalions were learning really well. And I think, you know, when we look back at
again, the legacy of IOC, the legacy was not so, the importance of that legacy wasn't so much in these specific tactics we were learning. It was in the mindset that prepared us to be rapid learners and to learn from our early mistakes in Iraq and, you know, about everything. You know, intelligence driving operations, the use integration of signals intelligence, counter IED tactics, mechanized operations, counterinsurgency itself. You know, all of those things. We had a steep learning curve, but by and large, I thought we learned well during that year.
Well, you know what? People ask, you know, about the experience, and they say, you know, and I'm asked on occasion, like, what do you think would surprise people about your experience? I said, the intellectual depth of them.
Yeah.
I said, if you could imagine the trying to fight in that environment, there's a physical environment, there is nobody in a different uniform, right? And so it's 1,000 shades of gray, right? The civil military problem, you know, that they can't come out and say they support you, especially when there's a camera near. But as soon as the camera goes away, they'll look at you and they want to do business. And they want to know if you're going to stay. They want to know if you're really serious, because it was, it's almost humorous. They would always ask, like, yeah, but what do you want? You're gonna turn the power back on. You're gonna fix it. You're gonna turn the water back on. You're gonna fix the irrigation system. And what do you want? You're just gonna give it back to us, right? And you expect us to believe that? You're going to stay, aren't you? No. It's not what we do. It's not how we do it. And they had the hardest time because nobody does that, right? Nobody does that. And so, but I just to dovetail off your point. The intellectual breadth of these problems, as you would sit down and try to, you know, kill bad guys, do civil military stuff, be culturally sensitive, right? Keep your own Marines alive, and all the things you did as a leader, was absolutely riveting. And I think that the training you got and the training I got, was absolutely critical to making sure that we could help facilitate those things happen. But the intellectual nature of it, and people are surprised by that answer, the intellectual nature of the problem is amazing. So now where do you go? So you get through Iraq, then where?
I'm just thinking a moment about what you said. That is a very, very good way to put it. Intellectual. Whatever alchemy we put into our officer training, I think that's a good example of how it worked. So I didn't go home quite yet. I went up to Mosul in January of 2005, and I'll talk about it briefly because it's kind of an interesting time. It was a very interesting time. So some of you remember that Mosul was the domain of the 101st Airborne Division,
right?
After the invasion in 2003 under General Petraeus. Petraeus did good things up there. And here's an interesting aspect when we talk about obeying and disobeying orders. So when the Coalition Provisional Authority in June of 2003 passed an order that basically said it was anti-Ba'athist. It was you could not it fired every member of the Iraqi army, and not only that, but it prohibited anyone who had been a Ba'athist or held a part of the Ba'athist party from being hired on by the new administration. It was an incalculably stupid order, you know, I mean, because guys had joined the Ba'athist party under Saddam simply to survive. Right. So now you are making tens of thousands, probably even hundreds of thousands of people unemployable, some of whom had military training, many of whom were armed, and you'd turn them against the new administration, you turn them against the U.S. So if there's one single act that fomented the insurgency, and there were many acts, but if there's one single act, it was that. You know, if I'd been in a position to disobey that order, damn right I would have, because even at the time we thought it was stupid.
You could liken it after World War II to try to run Germany without anybody who was a National Socialist.
Exactly.
You know, and I think Eisenhower got told that, and he looked at him and he said, you can't do it. And as Andy said, if you were a Sunni, you were going to be part of the Ba'ath Party, and if you wanted a job, if you wanted a career. And so, you know, between that and stopping paying the military pensions, we created the problem that was, and the other frustrating part, having had General Zinni on, right, all of this was predicted to happen in the war plan. If you don't do these things, this is what you will get. And it all came to be because we didn't listen. It's just very, in retrospect, very frustrating that the people who were privy to the theater war plan, right, that had been done and redone and redone, you know, ripped it up. Secretary Rumsfeld ripped it up and he wrote his own war plan. And it makes you sad because of the people we lost doing it. Not only ours, but the civilians that have been killed. Horrible. Horrible.
Incalculably. Yeah, it's just incredible. And, but anyway, so interestingly enough, Petraeus up there in Mosul, and he was a little ways away from the flagpole, so he could probably escape. That might be a reason why he managed to do this, but he ignored that order. So if you look what he did up there in Mosul, he brought on a lot of guys to, you know, to run the police, to run the what was then called the Iraqi National Guard, who were obviously, you know, were former Baathists. And his rationale at the time made sense. If we don't use these guys, they're going to turn against us. These guys are only hope. But fast forward, late 2004, I believe, or mid 2004, 101st Airborne left Mosul and were replaced by a single brigade in the Strikers, who lacked the same kind of culture ethos as 101st Airborne. You know, they didn't, you know, Petraeus, of course, became, along with General Mattis, kind of for the U.S. military, one of the dual fathers of modern counterinsurgency doctrine. So he understood the fact that you had to saturate the streets with your guys, whatever risk that entailed, if you wanted to hold down that city. But the brigade that rolled in on top of them didn't have that same ethos, and they didn't have the manpower. And so Mosul went to crap in a heartbeat. And one of the unfortunate aspects of Fallujah, and I would love to say that Fallujah was a resounding success because I was part of it, but the fact is it flushed. We killed a number of insurgents, but we missed Zarqawi, we missed the leadership, and it flushed a lot of insurgents elsewhere in the country out into, you know, Ramadi, into Western Anbar, but also up into Mosul. And so the police disintegrated in Mosul. There was nothing. And it just became a kind of a no-go area for the U.S. military. The brigade there suffered a number of casualties, 70 wounded, 10 killed in a single incident when a bomb was set off in their chow hall on a FOB. You know, that's how insecure they were. It wasn't they were taking those casualties, trolling the streets. So anyway, fast forward, January 2005, the Iraqi, what was then called Man Stinky, which was the U.S. command charged with training the Iraqi army and deploying them with advisors. They decided to send a brigade up of Iraqis to fix Mosul. And those Iraqis, because we'd learned our lesson, were drawn exclusively from Saddam's Republican Guard Special Forces. So they were pretty good dudes, by and large. I mean, good, I don't mean good as in morally good necessarily, but they knew their business. And I was one of the advisors assigned to that brigade. And it was a very interesting time, as you can imagine. We moved out into the city, took over the police stations, and then it was basically, you know, it wasn't a counterinsurgent so much as a war of attrition for 3 or 4 months. And it wasn't until that summer of 2005 that we started to see noticeable improvements in Mosul and as a functioning police force again. But it was a formative experience for me. I was placed in charge of an advisor team because the Army advisor, the guy who led that team, had simply just quit because of the level of danger. And he and his, you know, it's easy for us to be dismissive of these guys, but
right.
They had been, you know, they were Army reservists. They weren't even combat arms dudes. And so they were told that this mission was simply going to be involving training the Iraqi army on a base. So you can imagine that, and this is more a comment about army manpower system and assignments than it is about those guys, because they get out there and not only are they sent into a mission that they hadn't trained for, but it was a really, really tough, dangerous mission. And they were ill-equipped. So by ill-equipped, I mean, shit, I had in my team, on the Army side, I had 4 Marines. And among the 5 Army guys, I didn't have a single combat arms dude. I had a guy who played trombone in the band. I'm not lying to you.
Come on.
You know, and they hadn't done it. It's not like Marine training, so they'd all at least been at the range in the last year, whatever. These dudes did not, you know, they just hadn't had any of that. They'll quit, but I'll tell you, so it's very easy for me to dwell on, hey, I had this guy who quit, but the others who stayed had a lot of courage, and you know, their approach to me was, hey sir, you might not want to send us on the streets because we're not really sure what we're doing, but there's other ways we can contribute.
Wow.
And they did, you know, and so I was very, very dependent on, actually I did have one Army infantry guy and the Marines. We were hanging out on a limb for a while because we were going out on patrols in white pickup trucks. We had one helmet. We didn't feel in good conscience we could go out in that when the Iraqis who were with us were unprotected. You know, it was again a case where I was trying to balance orders, which were all U.S. advisors should travel in an armored vehicle, with my sense as a leader. You know, I was leading these guys. The Iraqis were our guys. That I couldn't ask them to do things that, you know, while we were sheltering in an armored vehicle and asking them to take much bigger risks than us. So anyway, sorry, a little lengthy, but it was a...
No, I mean, that's...
It was a really formative time.
That's what forms you. All right, walk us through the rest of the billets, and then I don't know how you are for time, Andy. Do you have time to do this today? Do you want to come back tomorrow?
Yeah, no worries, yeah.
Okay.
So I returned to the States in the summer of 2005. I went to SOAR, the School of Advanced Warfighting, which was... just a terrific experience. You know, I know in the Marine Corps it's kind of blasphemy to say that anything other than command is fun,
right.
But command is rewarding, but the year at SOAR was just pure fun. You can imagine, I mean, just 16 majors, all of whom very smart guys. It was sort of feeling I had at IOC, just, you know, great peers, great discussions.
They have a great curriculum to include getting around the country and sometimes over to France and traveling. And I mean, when you hear somebody comes out of that program, they are a cut above their peers. And it's a great program in the Marine Corps. And a lot of the names that you've heard us mention before went through that program. And so you go from there. From there, where to, Andy?
Yeah, from there, I kind of payback tour. I went to Mar 4 Pack in Hawaii, and then that was just for a year because then I got selected for command, and I took one free Lava Dogs in Hawaii. I took command of them in 2007, and we deployed to Kama, Iraq in 2008. And the interesting aspect of that story, the battalion that we took over from, which was 2-3, which was commanded by a friend of mine named Max Gallier. They were struck by a suicide bomb just days before the turnover, and Max and several of his guys were killed. I mean, it was a dreadful time. We rolled in on top of that, and I realized that everything that most of what we had planned for, we had to reconsider because the atmosphere there had obviously changed. So it was you know, karma was always a bad place. And years later, when I returned to Iraq in the counter-ISIS campaign, karma was again a bad place. I don't know what it is. It's a bad, bad place.
No, it's, you know, I mean, I think, Andy, wasn't historically a Revolutionary Guard community? I mean, that's why it was always, you know, when I was there in 2006, and Dave Furness was up in with 1st Battalion 1st Marines was up in Karma, and Karma was a shithole then. It was always a problem, and you know you know everybody does their best with it, right? But you know, there's I had heard that it was a Republican Guard community where a lot of them lived, and now, which was one of the reasons, but yeah.
Well, you're right. There was certainly a strong connection with the Saddam regime there, and when they emptied Cropper and Booker and all the you know the detention facilities, which was the time that we were out there, and released these dudes back to their hometowns. It seemed like a disproportionate number of those guys came back to Karma. Yeah, it was a bad place, but you know, every battalion commander likes to think that the place is better when he turns it over, and that's kind of why we fought the war sometimes 6 months at a time.
Right.
After that, I went to the war college, did a tour in Europe, was involved in evacuation from Libya when I was at SOCUA. I was the dude who went forward to coordinate the evacuation of U.S. citizens from Libya, which in turn led to a fraught incident where I was almost rolled up on the tarmac in Tripoli by Gaddafi's, his militia, not his mainstream army guys, but that's a separate story. Anyway, fast forward, when I make colonel, I was fortunate enough to be selected for command for what was then called the Marine Special Operations Regiment, and I took command there in 2012, late 2012. Had the regiment for just under 3 years, and then took the Combined Special Operations Task Force that deployed to Iraq in the counter-ISIS fight. And that was significant, really significant for us as Marines, because that was the first time that Marines had led an 06 level Special Operations Task Force. And we went port and starboard with the SEALs. You know, we'd lead one, and actually they would then lead the next two. But it was, you know, as you can imagine, it was an extraordinary time. In some ways, nothing that I had done previously prepared me for that particular mission. We had to stand up this task force in a short period of time, 6 months, 10 months in all to train them. But it wasn't as though we were given a cohesive unit. This was an ad hoc, very ad hoc affair. I couldn't just simply take the Marine Special Operations Regiment. We took a nucleus of guys from MARSOC. We took Marines from all over the Marine Corps. We took, a chunk of SEALs. Maybe a third of the headquarters were SEALs, but from different units, not from one particular unit. And then odds and sods from five different countries and all services. So you can imagine bringing those guys together and then training them for a mission that we, frankly, we didn't know exactly what it entailed.
Let me ask you, when does the regiment stand up? What year?
The regiment stood up I want to say 2000. So MARSOC stood up in 06, right. But I think the regiment didn't actually stand up till 08.
The regiment, and is this when it deploys and you command for the first time? Is that the first time the regiment, the regimental headquarters, deploys and does that?
Yeah, but it wasn't the regimental headquarters. That was the tough thing. We had to leave the regiment at home because the regiment had man, train, and equip responsibilities for all three Marine Special Operations battalions.
Got it. So you took select people and you went forward with that.
That's right. Yeah, it was an absolute ad hoc stand up organization, and it was tough. So getting everyone ready, and then the things that we started to, when you have plenty of time, you have a little more time to mentor people and get them up to speed. But when you're staring a mission like that in the face, and you've got so little time, it's really hard when you have guys who are obviously not up to speed. And sadly, some units took this as an opportunity to, for want of a better word, just shit can individuals who weren't performing, so hey, this is a great mission for him, we'll put him in a campaign against ISIS because he's not performing here in Camp Smith, Hawaii, as a logistics officer, But
talk about, I will say this though, and we talked about this on the program before, but the different training that was available. I mean, the stuff that I don't know if you were able to get out to somebody's version of Enhanced Mojave Viper or any of that. The training that the Marine Corps created was unbelievable. Were you able to, before you left, were you able to do any of that?
No. So this was 2015.
Yeah. Oh, that had all wound up.
But we did put together for the subordinate units, the Special Operations Task Forces, they were able to, and down to team level, they were able to do a lot of that. And we did all the training that we needed on the tactical side, and then we put together a series of CPXs in Fort Bragg, just getting us to work together as a headquarters. And then just very, very quickly, because I think this might be something that interests your readers. So, you make all your best laid plans. We came up with a campaign plan. We thought we knew how to go after ISIS, and we got out there. And during the period of assessment, we realized we had to do this a different way, and modify a plan to bore little relation to the original one. And here's why. First, span of control. I realized that although on paper I had 9 different task forces under me, 8 were foreign, 1 was a SEAL task force. They all had different authorities, and only that SEAL task force could really get around and do things. So the span of control for that one task force was huge. It was all of Iraq. I mean, it was just unmanageable. So I realized I needed another U.S. task force. And so I put in a request for forces to get a Marine Special Operations Task Force out there based on a battalion headquarters. And I pushed hard for that. And that caused no small amount of controversy, as you can imagine, from the SEALs, who took it as kind of a criticism, a place of criticism that they weren't getting the job done. And even frankly from MARSOC, who were like, what are you talking about? We can't afford to send you another battalion. Anyway, so that was number one. And number two was, and this will, you'll like this one because it goes all the way back to IOC and all and the training that we had about looking for enemy's center of gravity and its critical vulnerability. So the campaign plan as was for coalition forces in Iraq was simply to support the Iraqis as they trudged their way, to win back the cities that ISIS had captured. The problem with that is that they were fighting on ISIS's terms, and it was going to take 2 years, at a card grinding war of attrition to get up to Mosul, which was really the capital of the caliphate. And so armed with my memories of, hey, you go after the enemy's center of gravity, that's what we focused on. Mosul. Mosul, it was more about territorial gain. Mosul was where Baghdadi was. It was where he issued the declaration of a caliphate. It was right. The spiritual and physical heart of the caliphate. So we worked right away on just hitting him in Mosul, targeting his guys, but also fomenting rebellion amongst the citizens of Mosul, and launching raids with Sunni tribesmen on the outskirts of Mosul. So kind of a three-pronged effort there. But anyway, that's...
Hey, Andy, well, I mean, there's a couple things. First of all, I'd love for you to come back and talk about that. And you know, we can get a couple unclassified map chips. And I do I do these battlefield studies, and if you can explain, because I know that, that those of us watching it from afar thought, you know what, that's a big city. That is tough sledding. That is going to take years. Because, you know, you're going to ask your infantry units to go through and clear people out, or you're going to use infantry maneuver to set up your firepower, and you're going to lay waste to a city. You know, how do they do it? And, you know, and with, you know, the Iraqi formations were fragile, you know, and how many casualties can you sustain before they quit? And so all that, you know, all those factors go into how do you crack this nut? I'd love for you to come back and talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely, Mac. And I've taken up a huge amount of time, but it's been awesome just catching up.
Here's what I want to. So then you wind up finishing up as what, chief of staff?
Yeah. So I went to SOC Cent, Special Operations Command Central. His from the Marine. The Marine Corps' perspective, here's kind of what we're wrestling with right now. We've obviously MARSOC is here to stay and has won its place in the special operations community. But we are really, really light on the bench when it comes to having 06 level representation in the decision making. Headquarters, the operational headquarters throughout Special Operations Command. We do have O6s there, but we have very few, just the nature of our, you know, the way our Special Operations community is, very few with background or experience in Special Operations. So right now, you know, when I left at SOC Cent, I was the only O6 on a theater Special Operations our headquarters. So now there are none, you know, there was no Marine to backfill me. Which is, you know, I think in the course of time, we'll be able to have a footprint there, but it's a weakness it's just an inherent weakness in our ability to influence special operations at the joint level.
So all right, so here's what I want to do. We're going to stop today. Can you do this thing again tomorrow?
I can do it tomorrow. Okay. Yeah, no worries.
So what I want to do is I want to specifically talk about when do you say no, and I want to talk about the complexities of that, you know, from General Zinni before the war standing up, but Zinni wasn't in uniform. Shinseki was. He got dismissed. Greg Newbold resigned, and then you have a whole series of people, and I would tell you that you know. What we've done in Iraq, we've destabilized the entire Middle East, and we've been escorted there by the flag officers and the general officers of the United States military, and there's been a whole series of decisions that, at the time, you could have said, hey, wait a minute, shouldn't somebody say that we don't have enough people there? Hey, shouldn't somebody say that we need more bodies here before we fought this thing for 2 years? Shouldn't somebody say, hey, us unassing Iraq completely 2010, 2011 is not going to lead to good things? Should somebody, resign over stuff like that?
Or at least push back. At least push back because Congress has not done shit.
Well, the ground war in Afghanistan. Shouldn't somebody say publicly that I'm on board with the plan, but the American people need to be told that it's going to take probably 2 to 3 generations here.
That's right.
So we're going to be fighting here for probably, 60, 70 years. Now, we may not be fighting in the same capacity, but this is how this is going to work, because we're essentially creating something that's never existed on the planet before in this part of the world. So it's going to take us a while, and we're good with it. We just want to make sure the American people know. Stuff like that. So I want to kind of deep dive into that, because I think it's critical, and I think that it's morphed. The old standard of immoral, illegal, or unethical, to me, there's a fourth rail that goes in there.
Absolutely.
And I would say to the detriment of the nation, even if it isn't one of the first three, if it's to the detriment of the nation, to me, as a leader, because the politicians, I would say, aren't experienced enough, don't know enough to keep from doing this stuff. And now you look back in retrospect, the neocons thought that they could flip Iraq. It was a moderate, quote unquote, moderate Arab nation with a large, with a high percentage of people that had a relatively high degree of education, that we could go in there, knock it over, bring in expats, turn it back to them, in spite of everything the war plan said, and it would be a moderate, stable nation. And you look back on that, and you're like, you now think of what General Zinni said when he said, I don't know what planet these people are on.
Yeah.
And so I want to have those discussions with you and get your thoughts on where is that point when you as a leader have to look and say, I can't do this, and I will resign, and then I'm going to hold, I'm going to testify in front of Congress. I'm going to write. I'm going to make sure the American people have to deal with this criticism. And not just go away with a pat on the head. And so, where is that line now, and how do you do it? And I want to develop that in kind of a long format, because I think it's a really, really important discussion.
No, I agree. Yep. The obligation of U.S. military leaders to ensure that the blood of the nation is shed in some coherent cause, and simply hiding behind best military advice, well, you didn't take my advice, so I'm just going to troll along and execute, is kind of a, frankly, it lacks moral courage, and it's not in line with the ethics of our profession.
No, and I've told the story before, but when I do my post-traumatic winning thing that I go around to do, and I'll give you a call later, I need your help with that, but I'd like your help with that.
No.
But one thing is Dave Furness, when he introduces the program, the presentation, he talks about, picking up the phone and calling. I think he's lost over 100 Marines in his combat deployments. And he's called every family. And he doesn't have to do this. He could write them a letter. But he picks up the phone and calls them. And he said, one of the things that causes me to lose sleep now in my life is I have every one of the memorial service programs in a Bible that I guess when you graduate from VMI, they give you a Bible. He says, the Bible sits next to my bed. He said, all 100 of those programs are in the Bible. I've told every one of these families that I promise you we'll make your son or daughter's sacrifice, count, that they will not die in vain. And he said, now I watch the news, and I'm not sure that's going to happen. Do they think I'm a liar now? Do they hate me? I mean, what do they think of me? And he says, yeah. It causes me great distress, and it goes to that point you just articulated, Andy, which is, how do you ask the families of this nation to contribute family members, to a cause that is not, it's what the Vietnam veterans had to live with, that we're going to walk away from because we didn't think it through, because people didn't do their moral duty. And so I think it's a riveting subject, and I think it's one that we need to talk about more.
It goes right back to what you told us that day in Quantico about the implicit pact with the American people. And that's kind of what I was getting at. That discussion has had me thinking, and has had me thinking ever since. And credit to General Furness. I've gone through the same mental anguish of dealing with families and having told them the same thing. Your son's sacrifice was not in vain. But then that assurance becomes increasingly hollow. Anyway, yes, I agree with you.
Yeah. No. And again, I just think and if the military leaders of the country won't initiate that discussion with the political leaders of this country, then I think we have a terrible problem. And again, if you politics is, war is politics by other means. We go to war to create something that we want politically to exist on the planet. And that's why we go to war. And so, I mean, imagine if there was a moderate, stable Iraq in the Middle East, and that all that would have been contained inside Iraq, and that would have been transformed. It's a wonderful vision. But are you willing to send 300,000 to 400,000 you know, Marines and soldiers there to make it reality? And are you willing to do that for years, maybe a decade to do? And if you're not, Don Rumsfeld, you have no business doing that, because everything that was predicted to happen in the war plan ultimately happened. If you don't send enough, Shinseki got dismissed and sent home. And you watch all that and you just think, all the thousands of Americans that are dead, all the hundreds of thousands that are, of Iraqis that are dead. And that's immoral. That's immoral. And so anyway, so Andy, first of all, so you've written a piece called When Not to Obey Orders. It's in War on the Rocks. You have a book coming out. We'll end on this today. Tell everybody about the article kind of a precursor to the book? And tell everybody where they find the article.
Yes. So the article, if you Google, just When Not to Obey Orders, or actually, if you just Google my name, it'll probably come up. Mac, the article is not really a precursor to the book. The article, though, is connected to the book in the sense that the book's a memoir, but that having been said, it's not a there I was, I hope, SEAL type memoir. It's a memoir. And more importantly, it's about two things. It's about the guys with whom I've served. Indirectly in that sense, it's about the Marine Corps. It's about all of our experiences. And I think, if you were to read two or three chapters at random, you would see that was true. But the second part is it's about, I hate to use the term journey, but it's kind of the progression of the things that I've learned, often the hard way over the years, being a raw second lieutenant leading a platoon through Mogadishu to, you know, what we just talked about, leading a special operations task force against ISIS and an impossibly complex campaign. So I've tried to make it a story about the way things were, not about the way things I would have liked them to have been. So what I mean by that is I'm very honest about the mistakes of, and the fact that I've been very fortunate to have that circumstances and forgiving superiors have allowed me to progress. But in fairness, I've also learned as I progress. And so the story is about that too. It's like the things I've learned at, you know, tactical operational level, but also things like this, some of the moral lessons about, you know, the mission versus the men, when to disobey an order, and then towards the end, starting to ponder about what that means, what the implications are about, you know, the oath that you take and your professional ethics and your obligation to your subordinates, what that might mean at that nexus between, you know, the politics and military strategy, as you just explained. It is not a book intending a protest about anything or making a statement. But it's hard to talk about all the travails that we went through without finishing with some open-ended questions along the lines of what you just mentioned.
Well, and, I think people need to know, you know, this is one of the things I talk about in post-traumatic winning and mental health, which just kind of naturally leads into this moral dilemma. And that is, as long as I can not cry during taps or when we sing Eternal Father, I'm good, right? Wrong, right?
Yeah.
Most of us are faking it because we have these things that we've seen, that we've lived through, you know, people that you've watched die. And now you begin to try to sort it out because your life slows down a little bit, and then you find out you're not okay with it. And that things could have been done better, and people you expected to do things didn't do things, so it's a very interesting experience. It's a very interesting experience, and if you're not in the habit of talking to others, it can be very destructive, because you know, and then people that don't talk to other people often turn to alcohol, and as a way, which as we talked earlier, which is an accepted way to deal with it. Has been an acceptable way to deal with it in our culture. So, well, first of all, Andy,
just real quick on that. I'm a big admirer of the honest conversations you've had about that and the incredible tragedy of, you know, the story you tell about your sister and what tremendous courage and, you know, that she had, and how that has, you know, led you to have these discussions, which are very important discussions. And I couldn't agree more with what you just said. And again, if, you know, talking about, I feel as being honest in that book about that too. I have not handled, that aspect very well. I've tamped down problems that I've had over the years, and only recently post-retirement have confronted them.
But you know, I'll say this, you know, and I had an epiphany over the weekend about, you know, this, I was reading about the Air Force suicide rate. It's on a pace to more than double, which is astounding. The Air Force was the only service last year who saw their suicide numbers go down. They're now, they had 61 in 2018. They're already at 79 on a pace to get to 135 this year, which is astounding. And, you know, you see these articles and they say, if you have a problem, you know, don't be afraid to seek help. There is no stigma. Go. Well, it dawned on me because of something General Mattis said when I interviewed him, and Dave Furness says it too. We've got to know them better. And Mattis says, hell, Mac, the only reason I hung around this low-paying outfit was to hang out with Marines. And if you don't love them, you should get out. Because if you want to see the cost of a war, go to Bethesda, Lance Corporal, PFC, PFC, Sergeant, Corporal, Second Lieutenant, First Lieutenant, right? They're the most selfless, courageous things you've ever seen in your life. And if you don't love it, so as I put all that together, if that person is to the point where they're going to go look for help and the command doesn't know about it and your leaders don't know about it, then that is a leadership failure.
Thank you so much.
From the get-go. You've got to love them and know them better and be there to help them with this stuff. And we've all got to know that, hey, we're all dealing with it. And so that's what's exciting about this whole post-traumatic winning thing, is that nobody taught me anything. You know, I learned it as I went along. Nobody taught you anything. And we've got to be the first generation of Marine leaders or Marine retirees to turn around and say, hey, look, there's a better way. I can help you find that. And then what I want you to do is I want you not only just to fix yourself, I want you to go fix other people and experience that, and it'll change your life forever, I promise. And it's a powerful thing, but, I mean, you and I, we've all dealt with it on our own because there was no, the institutional way to deal with it was don't cry during TAPS. Don't cry when we sing Eternal Father, and you can be a drunk, right? But don't go to mental health. Now, that's all changed within the last, you know, 14 years, I would say, in terms of you can go to mental health. But there is much better ways for us to skin this cat. And I'm happy to say that a guy that we both know, Dave Furness, 2nd Marine Division is doing it. They've gone from 6 suicides in 6 months to 1 in almost 8 months. And that is not easy to do, and they're doing it. And so, we're all fighting it. We're all fighting it. My guest today is retired Marine Colonel Andy Milburn. Andy, first of all, I'll give you a call later, and we'll have you back on, and we'll specifically talk about when do you say I can't do that? What do you do? And get your thoughts about that. So I appreciate the visit this morning and look forward to doing it again tomorrow.
Terrific, Mac. Hey, thanks very much. It's been awesome catching up with you.
All right, bud. All right, I will talk to you.
All the best. Take care.
There you have it. Andy Milburn. How about that? If you can't tell, I have, like, one of the coolest jobs in the world. Yeah, straight up, man. And I love catching up with, you know, the lieutenant said, if you're fortunate enough to get to go back and teach at the basic school and the infantry officer course, they're the best. They're motivated, physically fit, fearless. They're smart, and they'll do anything. And I was really fortunate to have just an awesome experience. And then to this day, I mean, I have they continue to reach out because it was such a good experience for them, and I got to be part of it. As somebody who brought it to them, they reach out, you know, every month I hear from somebody, "Hey, Mac." And so it's really cool. And I'll tell you what, the other thing is you feel very proud of guys like Andy who went on to do, you know, who went on to do great things. And so, so very cool, very cool. So anyway, yeah, that went a little long, but I don't care. I'm trying to get Pat Horan to come on the program. Pat, in fact, interesting, Andy made me think of him. Pat was part of the Striker Brigade that went to Mosul in 2005. And one of the problem with motorized and mechanized units is that they don't have the quote-unquote ass that infantry units have. We experienced it in 2004 when the 1st Marine Division goes into Al Anbar, and I want to say in Ramadi, there was a couple of reserve units. One was a mech unit. They might have had 500, 600 soldiers. 2-4 goes in there with 1,100 Marines, reinforced infantry battalion in the Marine Corps. Yeah, same thing with Al-Qaim. The 3rd ACR was out there. They had a lot of Bradleys and stuff, but they're not heavy. Right? 3-7, Matt Lopez was a lieutenant colonel in charge of them. He goes in there with his battalion, and everybody starts poking around. And so, yeah, it's problematic. When you replace, it looks like, oh, they're replacing them. Yeah, that's not a straight-up replacement. And then you get all the problems that go with it. So it's really interesting stuff, I think, anyway. Hope you do, too. If you don't, it's okay. We won't hate you for it. Maybe a little bit. Nah, I'm just kidding. Anyway, have a great Monday. Keep the people involved in the shootings in El Paso and in Dayton in your thoughts and prayers. Sit down and talk to people you care about what to do when people start shooting. And, if so compelled, go out and get a concealed carry permit so that if something happens, you can help. On a Monday, All Marine Radio, over and out.